That table, please. Okay, one last time, council members, additional conversations, can you please move them outside the meeting room? Okay, we will move on with the Coast Guard Administration Act presentation. Dave Beliveau is here from headquarters. The floor is yours, Dave. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the council. On behalf of the Coast Guard Office of Vessel Activities and my superior, Captain Eric Christensen, and the Division Chief of the Fishing Vessel Safety Branch, Mr. Jack Kemmerer, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to come down here today. They would have been here, but they are doing a like advisory council meeting out in Seattle as we speak, and will also be speaking at a public meeting out at the Pacific Expo at the end of the week. Personally, I'd like to thank you for letting me come up here, because I grew up in the Cape as a boy, and I don't often get back to New England. And even though I'm going to be on the ground here less than 24 hours, it's nice to breathe in the good, clean air of New England. Before I came up here, I was told that most of you had read or seen presentations on the Authorization Act, and not to belabor every single aspect of the act and to get to a part of the act that dealt mostly maybe with the construction of vessels and some other timeline issues. So what I'll do just very quickly is I will go over very quickly just a quick review, hit the high points. Now, I've been told to tell you that this presentation is behind tab number one, and it is document number four. Okay, now what I think we all know what the law did, and in fact I did mention earlier that you've probably seen a presentation, a more detailed presentation of what the law did. Also in the Merchant Marine Safety Proceedings winter issue, fishing vessel issue, there was a detailed discussion. And on our website, the FishSafe website, there's also a discussion. But we know that certain sections of the law changed. The U.S. Code in Chapter 45, 46, and 51, and some of the areas impacted, and I said, like I said, this is the 10,000-foot level, parity for all vessels. It addressed survival craft issues, keeping of records, vessel examinations and certificates of compliance, training for operators, construction standards for smaller vessels, load line requirements, classing of vessels, and then there were other provisions such as training and research grants, extending the Commercial Fishing Safety Advisory Committee out to 2020, and then replacing wording of the boundary line with 3 nautical miles from the baseline. And this all has an effect on fishing vessel safety. Now, going ahead, the act was passed in October of 2010, and the regulatory strategy that the Coast Guard wants to follow is that they intend, the rulemaking team that is working on this, intends to publish an interim rule, also known, it can be also called an interim final rule. And the focus is on the implementing of the mandates of the law. So this is deemed to be the fastest means of implementation. It is the rule language will follow the Authorization Act verbiage to the letter, no discretionary language. Now, it won't be completely exact because it'll have to be changed for grammar and readability, but there'll be no substantive change, no, as it says there, discretionary language, no interpretation on our part as an agency. We'll utilize, or what the intention is that to utilize the good cause exemption to the APA, which is the Administrative Procedures Act, since delays would frustrate the rule's purpose and would be contrary to the public interest. It defers the need for notice and comment procedures. So the operative word here is defers. Once the interim rule is published in the Federal Register, then you can make comments on that. It allows for the statutes to become enforceable. And then after the interim rule is published, then the intent is to come up with a final rule to follow. And when you have the final rulemaking, we all know there's going to be public meetings and a comment period. And the final rule will provide discretionary and interpretive language, i.e. the actual regulations that the Coast Guard is supposed to write. Now, as we go on to the next slide here, in some sections and subsections of the Authorization Act, there are dates that requirements become effective or implementing otherwise implementing rules will need to be established. Where dates are not identified, the Coast Guard interprets the timeline as approximately 2 years from the date of enactment to implement the new requirements or initiate new authorities. Now, what you see before you, the dates here, these have been called out. These are dates that you can find interwoven in that Authorization Act, and they have been called out specifically. And I'll just give you a second to review those dates. And, of course, you have them in your presentation folders so that you can review them at your leisure. Okay. Now, the question that I've been told that's on a lot of people's minds is, are you thinking of building a new fishing vessel? Now, I know in the Federal Register recently we've seen where the New England Management Council and the Mid-Atlantic Council are thinking of changing how they're doing business as far as allowing people to modify and possibly replace vessels in certain fisheries. So I imagine that that is of a concern to people that are thinking of going ahead with building some new vessels. So the law affects the construction of new vessels that operate beyond 3 nautical miles from the baseline from which the territorial sea of the United States is measured, or 3 nautical miles from the coastline of the Great Lakes. Vessels are grouped into 3 categories, basically, although there are some others, but the 3 major categories are vessels less than 50 feet overall in length built after January 1st, 2010, vessels 50 feet overall in length or greater built after July 1, 2012, and vessels 79 feet or greater in length and built after July 2012. And just a note here that overall length can differ from registered length. And that's usually if you have a multi-hulled vessel. Now, if we go to the vessels less than 50 feet overall in length, the law says those vessels are to be built in a manner that provides a level of safety equivalent to the minimum safety standard the Secretary may establish for recreational vessels under Section 4302 U.S. Code. Now, the existing regulations for recreational boats that apply are 33 CFR Part 181 and 33 CFR Part 183. And those parts pertain mostly to flotation and other systems. And topics covered include, but are not limited to, safe loading, safe powering, flotation requirements, electrical systems, fuel systems, and ventilation. Now, I'd also like to point out, which I don't have here on the slide, but there is a boat builder's handbook. Okay, and that was made in concert with a grant between the Coast Guard and the American Boat and Yacht Council, and it gives guidance on building a boat to the standards in those regulations. And you can find that at the U.S. Coast Guard boating.org website. Now, I have an information sheet on that, which is not part of your presentation, but it will be available on the table outside, and I've made 75 copies. What that also does, it gives you a point of contact for Mr. John Ady, and it has a phone number and an email. And I would say that what that is that is, since recreational boats don't have a class society per se, that is the closest thing that you'll come to that. Okay, now for vessels over 50 feet overall in length and greater built after 1 July 2012, those vessels that are built after that date are subject to classification society survey and classification requirements. That means construction standards that your vessel needs to meet will be determined by the classification society that you choose. And I'll get to that in a minute, a little bit more of an explanation on that. Okay, vessels 79 feet or greater in length and built after the date 1 July 2012. Such vessels that are built after that date, subject to load line requirements. Load lines can be issued by the classification societies on behalf of the Coast Guard. So we don't issue them per se, they issue them on our behalf. Now, in both cases above, as noted, the Coast Guard does not prescribe the structural standards. The USCG accepts the standards of the class society that will survey, class, and or load line your vessel. Now, moving on to surveying, classification, and load lines, before you cut steel, form cement, or lay fiberglass, or fasten some wood together, this is where the process might change for a lot of you that maybe have been used to building smaller vessels. I know as a boy on the Cape growing up that a lot of guys that were carpenters and electricians and did other work during the summertime when things kind of dried up. If you drove by some of my friends' houses, their dads and uncles were out in the back with welding torches. And they were building boats in their backyard. And then come springtime, you'd have three or four new boats in the neighborhood and out on the water. This classification and surveying is, so far, has been more for larger vessels. So this might be a new process for people that are building smaller boats. And it's a collaborative process with the builder and owner has a dialogue with a recognized class society. Okay, so you get a hold of a recognized class society and you make your intention known that you want to build a vessel. Now, once the builder, owner, and a class society agree to work together, then the process starts. Okay, and that's something a little new. The class societies, you tell them what you want to build, and they decide whether they're going to make the rules or change their rules and work with you, because the class societies are businesses. Now, in classification survey, the classifications provide assurance that a set of requirements laid down in rules and standards established by the classification societies are met during design construction and are maintained during operation. Survey and classification processes can include plans approval, pre-construction. Now, that's something, that's why I said earlier, before you cut steel or do anything and start to spend money, in order to get a vessel classed, the plans have to be approved. And that's the first step in getting it off the ground once you pick a class society. Okay? Review of technical drawings for compliance with class rules, surveys during construction, usually hull and machinery, alterations, they have to be approved, surveys of control equipment, workmanship, which is shipyards, issuance of evidence of class and hull machinery certificates, and then there are periodic surveys, annual usually, and dry dockings at different periods of time to verify the vessel is maintained. So once the vessel's classed, then it has to be maintained to class. After classification and survey, if you're a larger vessel, then you get a load line. And the purpose of having a load line is to ensure the seaworthiness of the intact vessel, undamaged. Load line assignment process can include stability review and approval, freeboard calculations, conditions of assignment, survey reports, exemptions and equivalencies, issuance of load line certificates, and annual surveys or class surveys. Now, if you have your vessel classed, the additional requirements to get a load line are very minimal. Okay, very minimal. Okay, now I have out here some classification society contact information. And I would say here as a disclaimer that the Coast Guard does not endorse any class society one over the other. That's not our job to do that. In fact, we are not allowed to do that. The only class society that is not up there of recognized class society, what we consider recognized class society, is Germansker Lloyd, or GL. And the reason they are not up there is, according to our class liaison, they're not showing any interest right now in developing fishing vessel rules at this time. Now, as I said, I can't endorse any one over the other, but I can tell you that DNV has held some outreach and meetings, because it is DNV's stated goal that they want to have their rules for fishing vessels in place before the July deadline. That is their goal. Whether they'll do that or not, I don't know, but they have stated that as their goal. And to that end, DNV has had some meetings with fishing vessel examiners, our fishing vessel examiners and coordinators, mostly out in the West Coast, and with local builders, people interested in building out on the West Coast. And they held a meeting on 23 August in Seattle. They held a meeting on 24 August out in Medford, Oregon. In 26 October, just recently, they held one down in Mobile, Alabama, with some of the Gulf Coast builders and fishing vessel coordinator down out of District 8 in New Orleans. And it was actually held at Bayou La Batre. And then on 15-17 November, they'll be DNV is out now, as we speak, out in Seattle at the Fishing Vessel Safety Advisory Committee and at the Marine Expo. So I would say that if there is an interest here in the New England area for getting together with these class societies in this collaborative process, then you can do some outreach through how it has been doing, has been going out in the districts. Is they've been going through actually calling the point of contact for DNV, and then coordinating with our local district fishing vessel safety coordinator, which in this case would be our own Mr. Ted Harrington, who I'm quite sure you're very familiar with. But those are the points of contact and their names. Now, I can tell you that ABS currently has rules for vessels under 90 meters that have been applied to vessels of 50 feet or more in length. But I have to, and I can't stress enough, that this is a collaborative process. Class societies usually make their rules by committee, and those committees are made up of course, the class society surveyors, but also the constituency, yourself, whoever wants to build the vessel, and it is a collaborative process. So that might be a little bit different than, like I said, what you're used to. Now, to put some names to what's going on with the Coast Guard, rather than use the ubiquitous us and they and we, I'd like to direct your attention to this slide. And these are people that you can contact with specific questions that should be able to help you out. The first is Mr. Jack Kemmerer. He is the division chief for the Fishing Vessel Safety Division, and he is the subject matter expert technical advisor who is working on the rulemaking that impacts most of the Fishing Vessel Safety Authorization Act requirements. The next person on the list is Mr. Richard Walter. He is the project counsel assigned to that reg writing team, which means he is the lawyer that oversees a lot of the legal questions and rule implementation questions. Of course, there's Mr. Ted Harrington, who I mentioned earlier. He's your local contact for fishing vessel safety here in the New England region. And then we have a Classification Society Liaison Officer, and that is Mr. James Rocco. Okay, and you can contact him for if you have any questions on classification societies, and if for some reason or another you're having trouble contacting any of the people that we referred to here in this previous slide. Okay, and that concludes my presentation, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dave. Questions from council members? Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had several questions. One was really about process, and you did mention early on in your presentation that it is your intention to publish an interim final rule that will implement regulations and then have a public comment period and public hearings and then come forward with a final rule following that. So that's a very different process. I mean, that sounds like you're going to have, you know, regulations go into place that will affect fishing vessels that were likely to cost, you know, buying new equipment and things like this under an interim rule, and that the industry won't know what the final rule is until sometime later. Is that correct?
What it is, ma'am, is the and you're right, this is a little bit different than I've seen usually. But what it is, it's the interim rule defers the comment. And what it does is it just puts the language of the law into a rule. Like I said, we're not changing the language, only for readability, grammar, that type of thing, tenses. But it allows us to enforce allows us to verify and seek compliance with the law. But after the fact, once that interim rule is in there, you get to comment on it. And then there'll be a final rule, and that will include the discretionary language of how to actually implement by regulation how a lot of these programs are going to be run. So you get a comment period after the interim rule, but that interim rule basically, as I said before, allows for the statutes to become enforceable. And then the actual regulations of the final rule, it's the same thing that you're used to. That final rule gets another comment period, another public meeting period, and then it goes into actual regulation as a final rule.
Do you think you could just give an example of what you would think would be discretionary language, you know, that would change between perhaps your interim rule, which you say is going to be very specific to the statute, and then in the final rule, just kind of a sense of what the difference there is?
Okay, the difference is in the interim rule is that it is the actual language of the law. In other words, it's the mandate. For instance, the law says that a vessel over 50 feet operating in a certain area will be classified and surveyed. There's no discretion there for us whatsoever. Now, there's other parts of the law. Let's say, let's pick training, the training for fishing vessel personnel. Whoever is the operator will have to go through a training regime. You've read that in the law, I think. That does not have any date assigned to it. And it, in just very broad brushstrokes, talks about what that program has to cover. That could be right there. There's an example, because when are we going to say that you have to have this training certificate by X date? Okay, that would be something like. That is discretionary. In other words, the Coast Guard is the regulatory agency, now is allowed to say, yes, the law does not give a date for exactly implementation. It doesn't say, like for construction, okay, it doesn't say this will happen by this date. It says that this will happen, but it doesn't give a date. So there might be a phase-in period for something like that, so people have notice and can ramp up, because the training program obviously is going to have to be developed, and it is not developed in its final iteration as of now. In fact, the Fishing Vessel Safety Advisory Committee, that one of the subcommittees, worked on that in March, and that's one of their assignments. This meeting out in Seattle, that's one of the things they are working on.
Well, thank you for that example, because that was helpful. So would you think in your interim final rule that you would also include some measures that would be function as a proposed rule? I'm just trying to figure out on the discretionary items where the public is going to have an opportunity to comment, because you have an interim final rule and then you have a final rule. Even though you're having meetings in between, normally we would see, you know, a proposed rule and comment.
The interim rule, okay, only puts the language of the law as is, okay, into the rules so that the statutes become enforceable. Then you can comment. You can, after that goes in. In other words, there's no discretionary language in there at all. It's just what it is. It is, and I'm not trying to be flippant or anything, but as my grandfather used to say sometimes, it is what it is. You see it in black and white, what the law is. There will be no discretionary language in that interim final rule that is going to say to you, oh, and on top of here's the statute as is, there isn't going to be, and by the way, we think we're going to get this part of the act implemented, or like training or certificates of compliance or anything like that, off the ground by such and such a date. That can't be said in the interim rule. But you can comment on the fact how we've actually carried this out. And then the final rule, that's going to include the notice of proposed rule rate making, that whole process again, to get you to the final rule where you are going to comment on those final rules. And those are going to be, that's going to have your specifics. Those are where your specific language for For instance, how are we going to run the certificate of compliance program? How are we going to run the training program? And when must this be done by? That's how it's going to work. That's how it's been explained to me.
So that's fine. I was just looking for if there was a proposed rule that the public would have notice to comment on, and it sounds like there is. And then just one last thing. There was a discussion about this boundary line and the 3 nautical mile line, and I'm not familiar with what the boundary line is, but how much more, you know, how many more square miles are covered by this new move to the 3 nautical miles?
Ma'am, I do not know the answer to that question.
Do you know if it's significant, not significant? I don't know what the original boundary line is.
Well, what it's going to allow is that the boundary line is a elimination of the boundary line and then going from 3 nautical miles from where the territorial sea is measured. It's a more recognizable line, and it's actually on the charts. So it'll be easier for fishermen and boaters in general to recognize whether they are operating inside or outside. Because if you take a look at the boundary line language, which I am not fully versed in, period, comma, and quotation mark, is there's a whole section that has exceptions, like in the bay of, Cape on Cape Cod, where they draw the lines from between bays and bays that are open less than 3 miles. And like up in southeast Alaska, it leaves these donut holes in those inside passages. So it was done because it's more of a easily recognizable mark, and it'll enable people to understand where they're actually operating and hopefully alleviate a lot of loopholes and questions.
Jim.
Yeah, I'm interested in the section where it says develop alternative safety compliance programs for vessels at least 50 feet in length built before July 1st and over 25 years of age. Who develops the program and what will that consist of?
Okay, I can't tell you right now what the complete program will consist of because part of what is involved in the alternate compliance program may be in the final rule.
Okay.
Now, but let me say this, that a model for a program, okay, is the ACSA program, the alternate compliance safety agreement that we have now out on the West Coast with the processor fleet, which is about 51 vessels. And there is actually a multi-page book on how that whole program's administered and what it covers. And that is available on our FishSafe page and the D13 page. That'll give you a very good idea of what will be included, possibly included. Now, the second part of your question is who is going to do this? How they do it out in the West Coast and what we envision around the country, probably regionally, if you look at the language, is that you're going to get out there. We have all these processor stakeholders, and there's NOAA is involved. There's a lot of people with their hands in, and they sit down and they come to an agreement on how the program's going to be run. Okay, and then the rules of each alternate compliance program are made up and agreed upon between the Coast Guard and the actual users of the program, the people that are going to sign on and have their boats and vessels comply with the program.
In a follow-up, so in that once that program's developed, you have to develop it by 2017, but then it becomes effective by 2020. Is that how, am I reading that correct, or is
that? That is my understanding. In other words, the mandate of the law is that we have been charged as the regulatory agency to work with industry and to come up with these programs by that date, and then once we've agreed to what these programs are going to look like, then that 17 to 2020 date is like a phase-in implementation period, and it's recognized that you're not going to be able to flip things overnight and have people comply with these things. There might have to be some alterations to vessels, new equipment bought, things of that nature.
And one other question, I think. Do you have any idea, just off the top of your head, what a cost to have a vessel, what additional cost is involved in having a vessel built under class and maintained in class?
No, sir, I don't.
Anyone else?
If I could just follow up, sir, that's one of the reasons I gave out the points of contact for the class society contacts and our class liaison, because really, to get to the crux to that question, you're going to have to, if you're building a single boat, okay, if you're not a yard, like out in the West Coast, there's a yard that builds, it's like a patent 58-foot vessel, and they turn them out pretty regularly, okay? And they're going to know, that's why they've had some meetings out there, they're going to have, they have a better idea of what the cost additional to them as a yard is going to be, because they're liaising with DNV. They happen to be DNV. Now, for an individual builder, let's say, that's why you have to contact the class society and start a dialogue before, as I said, before you cut steel, before you commit yourself to spending money. The only way you're going to know what your additional cost may be is to contact the class society and start to work out with them how they are going to administer the building and classing of your particular vessel or series of vessels.
Jim and then Dave.
Well, I have a pretty good idea what it's going to cost. I just wanted to know if the public knew. First of all, you start spending money the day you call the class society. So to say you got to do that before you spend money, that's not that. You spend money the minute you call them.
Now, I understand that, sir.
So, I'd submit we're going to have a fleet of 49.11-inch boats here, and that's it. So our diversity discussions can end today. That's it.
Dave Gaethel.
The title of the law is Uninspected Commercial Fishing Industry Vessels, and I think there's a lot of confusion around what is uninspected. I mean, in New England, basically, it's everything. But we have, for example, and I'm going to use bluefin tuna as an example. In order to fish for bluefin tuna, if you get a general category or a harpoon category, you're considered a commercial vessel. But that fishery takes place across a number of different vessels, both inspected and uninspected. So in the way of outreach, I think it will be necessary for you to reach out to, say, the charter headboat category as an example and tell them, you know, they're an inspected vessel, but if they get a general category tuna permit, they will have to comply with this commercial vessel, all these various aspects of this. I think you're going to need to clarify that. And the other ones, the six passenger boats that are uninspected, but, you know, basically operate in what I call almost a netherworld of, you know, they operate outside both commercial fishing and inspected vessels. But if they get a tuna permit, they're considered a commercial vessel, and therefore I assume they'll come under this law, correctly?
A commercial fishing vessel?
They are considered a commercial fishing vessel if they get a general category tuna permit.
Okay. I'm not up to speed on that niche market of the vessels, but I've written it down and so noted.
Okay. And it's a pretty large niche. I think there's about 10,000 general category tuna permits issued.
Okay.
So it's a pretty large number of vessels.
Okay.
They currently tend to operate more or less outside this stuff and are going to need to be educated about the requirements of and the dates and whatnot. So I just call that to your attention.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that very much.
Rodney.
Yeah, thank you.
I don't know. It may be this one.
Shut it off.
Yeah. Yeah, can you? Okay. One of the questions I get from industry a lot is, when is this going to be in effect? And I know the dates you got here. Those are the hard dates that this will be affected. I get plenty of comments, when do I have to buy my life raft? This is boats that fish inside right now, and they're going to be just over the three-mile line boundary. When do I have to buy my life raft? When do I have to document my mandated monthly safety drills? Right now they say they have to do them, but they don't have to have them documented. Will there be an outreach? Will the Coast Guard outreach to the industry prior to this? What the industry seems to be worried about is, and I asked Captain Christensen this and when the last time I was out in CIVAC, and he says as soon as it gets implemented, when somebody outside of 25, 3 miles and 1 inch is going to be violated. That's the way they would interpret the law, would need a life raft aboard the boat. So my question is, will there be an outreach effort to the industry prior to that date?
As part of the rulemaking process, that will come during the comment period and also public meetings. Okay, it's my understanding, and because, I mean, I can't discuss the specifics of a rule that is open, a rulemaking that is open. Under the Administrative Procedures Act, I'm not allowed to do that. I don't know what the wording is exactly, but I have been told that there are going to have to be, I mean, it's just common sense, that there's going to have to be some phase-in periods. You know, for instance, for the survival craft, I mean, actually, there's that dates right in the law. If you have a buoyant apparatus, you know, if you keep it in good condition, I think the law says that you can keep the thing till 2015. But after 2015, that 2015 date, the Coast Guard is, by the language of the law, will not be allowed to authorize the use of those, and the survival craft is going to have to be a craft that keeps the person up and out of the water.
Are you going to be around for any of the remainder of the day, or in case people offline had questions, because I'm thinking we need to move on with some of our other items on the agenda?
Yes, sir. I will be here for probably an hour or so.
Okay. All right. Unless anybody has a burning question, I would like to move on to our 1120 item under Herring. Thank you very much.